as you were developing this, is the whole part, the deep partnership approach that you're taking also a way to hedge against the typical complaints about aid projects in which there's a program that's imposed externally? It might be well received because it infuses resources and helps a smallish group of people. But then when the project leaves, it leaves a vacuum, or it's been delivered in an inappropriate way, or it's created expectations that aren't realizable. Do you see that your model ends up addressing some of these things, or what doesn't it address?
No, absolutely. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we say to our colleagues when we started this is that even if our colleagues in Africa don't know the solution to their problem, they at least know the problem better than we do. So therefore, the least we can do is to listen to them, to understand the problem, so that we can begin to formulate different solution strategies, so that they can say, well, this solution might not work because of this constraint and that constraint, and so forth. So it takes all those into account. It's about one of the advantages of this model. I just came back from an NIH workshop. NIH is funding a project right now in which they are looking at, you mentioned it, they are looking at the impact of georesources production on global health. This is what Penn State proposed to them. And this caught their attention so much that they decided to fund this project, even though we're talking about Niger Delta in Nigeria. And of course, when you talk about AIDS or malaria or whatever you talk about, you cannot divorce this from the issue of resource production and the movement of people around the world. So therefore, one of our colleagues who is leading the Center for Global Health, who I said is leading this effort from the College of Health and Human Development. And one of the things that they want us to do, which we propose to them, which they like, is that, look, if you look at resource production issue, it's not unique to Africa. Look at Mississippi Delta and look at Niger Delta. The difference is not that much, surprisingly. Mississippi Delta, very resource rich. 15% of the oil production in the U.S. comes from Mississippi Delta. And yet, endemic poverty in the place, just like you find it in the Niger Delta. So they now look, and by the way, they also refer to Mississippi Delta as the cancer zone in the U.S. So why do you have this link between global health, poverty, and resource richness? That's the question that now they want to engage in answering. So it's not just beneficial to the African, that's what I'm the research component, it's also very beneficial to the U.S. And those are the kind of things we are looking at. Mm-hmm. So the partnership is not just for the benefit of the Africans, it's also for our benefit as well.
Now, I have a bunch of questions, but I'd like to provide the opportunity. Anyone who wants to jump in, anyone who wants to relate relate what they're doing or what they know someone else at Penn State or elsewhere is doing that improves upon or has been or fundamentally or relates to the topic of the land grant mission on sort of a global level. That'd be fantastic. I did have a question, but I wanted to have someone from Extension Services here, and as it turns out, it didn't work out. Is there anyone here who's worked for Extension Services or an Extension Service? Because it's sort of a gap, and I wasn't able to get someone from Extension Services here on a reasonably short notice. My question is that there's certain funding models and certain reasons why the land grants were established, but also how extension services have evolved and what the contributions are and what the relationships are here in Pennsylvania, in places like Texas and in states that have very well developed programs. If we start thinking about how that model or how a variation in that model would work elsewhere, are there major gaps in what makes it work and what makes it sustainable that we would have to be accounting for? The reason why I'm thinking about this and been thinking about it for a bit was when I was in Central Asia. There were numerous people from Aga Khan, from local government, and so on, who had been on exchange programs, who had exposure to extension programs in the States. And there was tremendous interest in Uzbekistan for trying to replicate the model, the agriculture extension model in Uzbekistan. Now, Uzbekistan has fallen on some very hard times. And I don't think there's been very much progress made there because of the nature of shifts in the government. But But I'm not being so aware of either the intricacies of agriculture policy in Uzbekistan or the models that they were really referring to. The questions that I would have would be around what would you have to do to localize that type of model in a particular country? And so I wanted to throw that out, but I really don't know if we have the insights around this table right now.
Two people in outreach have had experience there. Pete Forrester, I think, in Uzbekistan, and Melanie Dobler up in WPSX, who has a master's degree in extension education.
Okay.
Has done some work for extension, but they're not here today.
No.
My African experience that I was making reference to yesterday was primarily based on a ag extension model. I was working out of a university, but it was not essentially the university, it was extension. The university that I had early relationship with was the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which prides itself as one of the early leaders and continue leading in the land-grant mission. For breakfast, as graduate students, we were expected to say the boundaries of the campus or the boundaries of the state. So a few years after I had acquired a bit more confidence, I stood up one day and I said, that's no longer relevant. The boundaries of the campus now are the boundaries of the globe. You know, this is blasphemous. An experience, therefore, to connect to your question, the Wisconsin people, when Kenya became independent, invested people, money, and commitment and were very successful. I mean, what I hear going on out of University of Nairobi today sounds very much like it was when I left there a lifetime ago. Yeah, I mean, there's some wrinkles on top of it, and, but in a way, that's a tribute to the people who came out of Wisconsin back then and did what they did. And I was reflecting when I was listening to some of the earlier comments. I'm always very concerned about quick dashes into places. I mean, usually they're kind of dysfunctional. There's no understanding of culture and time. American enterprises are very, they look for quick results. You know, jump in, try to do something, and be out in a couple of years or so. And usually, either cause damage. Or are you able to achieve long-term benefit? I mean, some use the word sustainability. I think in any of these conversations, we really need to keep the idea of, on the one hand, not doing harm, is the point I made yesterday. Secondly, whatever we do, doing it for the long haul. And then thirdly, and go back to the Wisconsin thing, I've got another experience and I'll stop. Accept that success means perhaps loss of influence. I mean, if the project worked, mm-hmm. after some time, it takes off, but that may take a number of years. So I don't think they're inconsistent. Do not intervene carefully. Intervene for sustainability, and intervene for withdrawal given success.